attacks by Israeli settlers in the West Bank are ramping up in frequency and intensity.
All of this is bleeding into the West Bank and making it impossible for Palestinians to even fathom a Palestinian state or an equitable political status.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, what is driving that violence? Also on the show, an Iranian filmmaker says his time in prison motivates his dissident movies.
When I left prison, I felt responsible toward the fellow prisoners who were still inside.
Plus, a taste of life in China's EV capital.
I've not been in an internal combustion engine car since living here because every car is electric.
That is all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here. If you are listening to us in a car, odds are it's gas-powered. Not so in China. The country produces nearly three-quarters of the world's EVs. As part of our week-long series on transformation in China, The World's Jeremy Siegel takes us to Shenzhen, the city that's home to electric car giant BYD.
Standing beside the main road in Shenzhen, you almost forget you're in a city of some 20 million people. On the surface, it looks like what you'd expect in a bustling megacity, a sea of headlights, hubcaps, and hellish traffic. But the roar of engines you'd usually find on a major thoroughfare, virtually non-existent.
I've not been in an internal combustion engine car since living here because every car is electric.
That's Bridget McCarthy, an American who moved to Shenzhen 3 years ago for work. We meet up in the city's Nanshan neighborhood, a business district home to thousands of tech companies. Out on the street, we see a sea of all-electric taxis made by the Shenzhen-based car company BYD, painted in a uniform blue and white. A bus pulls up to the curb, also BYD, also electric, with hordes of passengers hopping out and heading into a mall where Chinese-made electric cars are sold alongside trendy t-shirts, designer handbags, milk tea, and fried chicken. When we get inside the mall, McCarthy tells me this is all normal in Shenzhen. The local government has been at the forefront of requiring vehicles to go electric, and EVs have just become a given in everyday life.
Like, the buses in Shenzhen have been completely electric since 2017. Uh-huh. The taxis have been completely electric since 2018. That was when people weren't even buying passenger vehicles. And now, I think the most recent stat is, as of August, 85% of new vehicles sold here are fully electric.
McCarthy works for a hedge fund called Snowball Capital, which invests in EVs and green energy companies. They used to be based in the U.S., and McCarthy tells me years ago, she would never have imagined ending up here.
Basically, we were never planning on living in Shenzhen or China, but more and more as China kind of climbs the ladder in terms of tech, we started realizing most of our holdings were in China, and a lot of them, they're headquartered in Shenzhen.
Now, McCarthy tells me, it's hard to imagine being anywhere else. Huawei, China's version of Google, Tencent, the Chinese social media giant, DJI, the drone maker, and, of course, BYD, are all based here. The reason Shenzhen has become widely known as the Silicon Valley of China.
So Shenzhen has a lot of its roots as the hardware capital of the world.
That's Dan Wong, a technology analyst and author of the book Breakneck, which details how China is undergoing a technological revolution. Back in the 80s and 90s, he says, Shenzhen, which was the first city in China to open to foreign commerce, was nicknamed the world's factory. It was a place where foreign companies, enticed by government incentives, could go to have their products built with cheap labor. But then everything changed in the early 2000s.
When a very important company, Apple, decided to make the iPhone in Shenzhen.
At the time, Wong tells me, the decision didn't seem that consequential. Just another thing that'd be built in China. What Apple didn't realize was that outsourcing its production to Shenzhen would spark a new era of innovation.
What Apple was doing was training hundreds of thousands of Chinese workers every single year to make the most sophisticated electronic product in the world.
According to Wong, teaching Chinese workers to make iPhones was kind of like the old teach a man to fish proverb. Apple gave them a new skill and inspired a new generation of entrepreneurs with technical know-how.
A lot of these workers would move from making an Apple iPhone in their first year, maybe to making a Huawei phone the next year. And then they may be putting together a DJI drone, and then maybe an even more complex product, the electric vehicle batteries.
BYD, now synonymous with electric vehicles, wasn't even a car company to begin with. In the 90s and early 2000s, it built batteries for cell phones. But Wong says workers who learned from Apple and other American companies that move production to Shenzhen helped the company transform from battery maker to unknown car company, now to the world's top EV maker. In less than 20 years, Shenzhen, with BYD at its center, went from the world's factory to the world's premier innovation hub.
I think this is a city full of hope, full of stories, full of legendary stories, full of successful stories.
Finance professor Jinfen Zhang is an expert on the development of Shenzhen's economy. He says beyond the tech know-how acquired in manufacturing foreign products, the local economy has benefited heavily from the Chinese government.
The dynamics here comes from the private sector, but the government provides some support behind it. I think all this merged together to achieve this really extremely fast development.
The central government has pumped billions of dollars into BYD, helping it to refine their technology and flood the international market with cheap, efficient cars. Their fast charger only takes 5 minutes, and the company's lowest-end EV, the Seagull, goes for roughly $8,000, a seventh the price of the average EV in the U.S. Critics, including the United States, call these practices unfair. Here's how former President Joe Biden described the practice in a speech last year.
China heavily subsidized all these products, pushing Chinese companies to produce far more than the rest of the world can absorb, and then dumping the excess products onto the market at unfairly low prices, driving other manufacturers around the world out of business. It's not competition, it's cheating.
But supporters like Bridget McCarthy, whose firm is invested in BYD, say government support has allowed BYD to not only build cars, but to export a clean energy revolution.
I'm a huge believer in BYD's dream of actually becoming an energy company, not just a car company. And I think if we look at countries like Brazil, where they already have a huge market share, or Mexico, like, these are countries that without a company like BYD, they wouldn't really be able to progress into the future in terms of green energy.
For now, there are still parts of the world, like the U.S. and Canada, where you can't buy a BYD because of protectionist tariffs. But McCarthy says it's not a matter of if, but when that changes, because Chinese EV technology is simply too far ahead and too cheap for America to go it alone. For the world, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is in India today to meet with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Stepping off the plane in New Delhi, it was all hugs and handshakes. But major geopolitical pressures are still likely to pull the leaders of Russia and India in different directions. Chitij Bajpayee is with Chatham House, a think tank in the UK.
When we place this in a broader geopolitical context, it's clearly a significant visit. This is Putin's first visit to India in 4 years, and notably the first since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I think for India, it demonstrates that New Delhi maintains a diversified and independent foreign policy, that it's not beholden to the whims of the Trump administration. I think for Russia, it shows that it's not isolated despite Western sanctions. But I think more practically, both countries are essentially seeking ways to compensate for India reducing its imports of Russian oil by strengthening engagement in other areas. And this comes as India is under growing pressure from the West and the U.S. in particular, to reduce its purchase of Russian crude.
So tell me more about what they are hoping to get out of each other at this meeting.
So I think there's going to be a real push towards trade diversification. We've seen a significant increase in bilateral trade between both countries in recent years. It was less than $10 billion before the COVID pandemic. It's close to $70 billion right now, and the target is $100 billion by 2030. But much of that has been driven by the sharp increase in India's import of Russian oil. So I think there's going to be a real push to, as I said, diversify their trade, have a more balanced trading relationship. That'll entail efforts to try and improve market access for Indian products to the Russian market, potential deals in the defense space, in civil nuclear cooperation. They've also likely to announce a labor mobility agreement, which will establish a framework for legal migration of skilled Indian workers, and that would help to support Russia in sectors which are experiencing labor shortages, such as tech.
India has been purchasing less Russian oil since it itself has been sanctioned for doing so. Is Putin likely to try to convince Modi to change tax there to buy more?
I think it will, of course, try to do so. But historically, India has been more responsive to Western sanctions than, say, China. We saw, for instance, when the first Trump administration withdrew from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, India dropped its purchase of Iranian crude. So I think it's going to be easier said than done. India, of course, doesn't want to be seen to be acting under duress or under pressure from the West. It doesn't want to abandon its longstanding relationship with Moscow. So we could see energy deals manifest in other spaces. So, for instance, Indian companies continuing to buy oil from non-sanctioned entities.
Is that the major stressor in the Russia-India relationship right now, this issue of oil?
That is probably the most immediate issue. But I would say that in some ways the relationship is undergoing what I would call a managed decline of sorts. The Russia-India relationship doesn't hold the same geopolitical heft that it once had, particularly the heft that it had during the Cold War. We've seen, if you look at, for instance, people-to-people contacts, there are 10 times as many Indian students studying in the U.S. than there are in Russia. On the defense front, more than 50% of India's in-service military platforms are of Russian origin, but we've seen a gradual drop in India's dependence on Russian military hardware. And that's been fueled as well by the war in Ukraine, delays in delivery of spare parts and several platforms, Russia, of course, prioritizing its own defense needs. So I think it's not just about this pressure on India's purchase of Russian crude. I think there's also a question, again, if we take a step back, about the worldviews of both of these countries. I think India wants to project a worldview which is more non-Western, but not explicitly anti-Western. And that puts it out of sync with countries like Russia, but also, I would say, China and Iran and others.
Yeah, I was going to ask, the U.S. has long been trying to bring India closer as a security partner, especially, you know, with China in mind. Does that stand in opposition to the Russia-India relationship? Like, is there a bit of a tug of war here?
I think it is becoming increasingly difficult to square that circle. You know, India has maintained a longstanding position of strategic autonomy in its foreign policy, which essentially means engaging all major poles of influence in the international system. But strategic autonomy only works when all these poles actually get along with each other. So as relations soured between Moscow and Washington, the India-Russia relationship came under growing scrutiny, which is making strategic autonomy, I would say, increasingly difficult to sustain. But that being said, I think India still prioritizes its relationship with the West and the U.S. in particular, despite recent frictions with the Trump administration. I think the U.S. remains a key defense, technology, and strategic partner with India.
Putin is wanted for war crimes. India is not going to arrest him. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the issue here is, in some ways, India pursues a more pragmatic foreign policy. It's interesting to note that when Western countries talk about their relationship with India, they often refer to it based on the idea of common values. Every joint statement between India and a Western country will usually begin with the preamble, "We are two countries that share a common democratic heritage." But in practical terms, I would argue that doesn't say very much. You know, India doesn't usually use democracy promotion as a key tool of its foreign policies. In some ways, one could argue that India's foreign policy is more in sync with, say, China's approach than the approach of many Western countries in terms of its relations with weak or non-democratic regimes. So whether it be Russia, as we're talking about now, but I could also include, say, Iran or Myanmar. India's position, as I said, is more often than not aligned with China than it is with even the United States.
Chitij Bajpayee is a senior research fellow at Chatham House, a think tank based in the UK. He spoke with us from London. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Late last week, a Palestinian news outlet aired footage of Israeli security forces operating in the West Bank city of Jenin. It showed an armored construction vehicle breaking down the metal gate of a building. Two men come out of the building, holding up their hands and lifting their shirts, apparently to show that they are unarmed. The men look like they're surrendering, but then an officer starts kicking one of the men. Both are ordered to crawl back into the building, and Israeli officers open fire, killing both Palestinian men. The following day, Jeremy Lawrence, a spokesperson with the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, had this to say.
We're appalled by the brazen killing by Israeli border police yesterday of two Palestinian men in Jenin in the occupied West Bank, in yet another apparent summary execution. There are mechanisms. There's rule of law. There's due process. Ways in which you handle cases. The solution is not to pull a gun and shoot.
To talk about this incident and the overall situation in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, we reached out to Dalia Hatuka. She's a freelance journalist who splits her time between Ramallah, the de facto Palestinian capital in the West Bank, and Amman, Jordan, where she is now. Thank you for joining us, Dalia.
Thank you.
So this is not an isolated incident. Israeli security forces have been carrying out major operations in Jenin. What have they been up to?
They've been carrying out operations back to back, first from an earlier campaign called Iron Wall, and now we've got an Operation Five Stones. Basically, these are major campaigns that are going on in the northern West Bank, not just in Jenin, but also in Tubas and elsewhere. And what's happening is that throughout these campaigns, the Israeli forces are imposing sieges of some sort. They're blocking major roads, they're sealing off towns, they're carrying out house-to-house raids, turning civilian homes into temporary military posts, and there's been many detentions of Palestinians as well. The difference between this and other previous campaigns is that helicopters have also been deployed. In the broader West Bank, you know, this has meant more deaths and more killings, more than 1,000 people killed since 2025.
So regarding this incident that I mentioned a moment ago, last Friday, Islamic Jihad said that the two Palestinian men killed in that video were part of the Palestinian militant group. Do we know anything else about them?
Yeah, the two Palestinian men, they were 26 and 37, according to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. And as you mentioned in your intro, the video footage showed that the men, you know, had indeed surrendered. They lifted their shirts to show that they were unarmed. They lay on the ground and they were still executed. The incident was condemned not just by the United Nations, but also by Israeli human rights groups like B'Tselem. The victims' family members and local officials argue that the killing was cold-blooded and unjustified. One relative said a person who surrenders can be arrested, but eliminating him in such a brutal way is very wrong.
What have Israeli officials said about this incident?
The Israeli military and the police have acknowledged the shooting. They said that the men were wanted suspects, allegedly affiliated with what they called a terror network. They said that surrender procedure had been ongoing for several hours before the men exited the building. They didn't elaborate on that. And then the military said that after the suspects exited, fire was directed toward the suspects. The incident has been referred to, quote unquote, professional bodies for review. According to Israeli reports, also three officers from the border police unit involved have been summoned for questioning.
They did say that they are referring this for review, this incident, Israeli officials.
Correct. They did. But unfortunately, I mean, if we are to look at the past situations or incidents that are similar to this, there has to be a lot of skepticism because historically such investigations rarely lead to indictments or accountability. Mm-hmm. And also the official Israeli statement doesn't confirm why the forces opened fire beyond broadly alleging that the men were wanted suspects. It does not address why they were shot after surrendering or why they were ordered back into the building or whether there was any threat at the moment. So I think it remains unclear whether the men were armed or posed any threat at the exact moment they were shot. The video suggests they were unarmed and kneeling, and no public independent forensic findings or inquest results have yet been shared.
What are Israeli officials giving as the reason for these operations in general, these stepped-up operations in Jenin and elsewhere in the West Bank?
So Israeli officials claim that this is a security operation. They say that they're trying to weed out terrorists or militants and whatnot. If we look at the pattern, we see that it shows prolonged occupation instead and control of Palestinian towns, because the raids have been focused on controlling civilian movement, demolitions of civilian homes, detentions of civilians, and home seizures. It's really, you know, the statements that are coming out from the Israeli officials don't really reflect what's happening on the ground.
Right. You mentioned that part of the operations in the West Bank right now include blocking roads and putting some areas under siege. What does that mean for the day-to-day lives of Palestinians living there?
There is widespread fear. There is widespread trauma among communities with deep humanitarian consequences because, you know, you have major displacement. I mean, in the last military campaign, more than 40,000 people were displaced from places like Tul Kerem and Jenin and other places in the north. One thing worth mentioning as well is that public services, so you've got roads, water networks, infrastructure, repeatedly have been damaged and destroyed during these raids, making life harder for the remaining residents. And then finally, also schools have had to shift to remote learning in some areas because of curfews and increasing insecurity.
So aside from the security forces, there has also been a rise in violence coming from Israeli settlers targeting Palestinians. The UN says this has gotten much worse in the last several weeks through the olive harvest season. What can you tell us about that?
So as you mentioned, there's been a marked increase in both the frequency and the severity of Israeli settler attacks on Palestinians, especially after October 7th, 2023. To get to your point about the olive harvest season, settler violence happens all the time in the West Bank, but it's often concentrated during periods like the olive harvest season, especially because the harvest is vital to so many Palestinian livelihoods. And so the attacks are rampant, they're violent, they involve everything from shootings to beatings, with metal rods, to stealing crops and equipment, to chainsawing ancient olive trees or burning groves. I'm talking about dozens of trees at a time. And it's so cruel and unnecessary. If settlers really loved the land as they claim to, they would never mow down trees older than the state of Israel itself.
You mentioned the October 7th attacks. There's also, you know, been change in official Israeli government policy, which has sought to expand Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Do you see that as related to this uptick in violence?
Absolutely. What's happening is that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is proposing extending Israeli sovereignty over large parts of the West Bank. So in effect, annexing those areas. And his government has recently taken steps to formalize aspects of this. So approving settlement expansions, linking contiguous settlement blocks, changing planning frameworks. It's all basically, you know, quote unquote, creeping annexation. And it's having a profound adverse effect on Palestinians. Again, constraining movement, undermining property rights, displacing families, curtailing Palestinian governance, and intensifying settler violence. So you've got, you know, the settlers on the one hand, you've got the Netanyahu's government sort of pushing for these settlements on the other. And all of this is bleeding into the West Bank and making it impossible for Palestinians to even fathom a Palestinian state or an equitable political status.
I don't want to ask you to try to predict the future, but where does it feel like things stand right now, and what kind of road is this going down?
Unfortunately, the implications are profound. So if realized, these moves could effectively end the two-state solution as currently conceived, and they can shift the dynamic to something else. For example, a fragmented set of Palestinian enclaves or a unitary state with unequal rights, with Palestinians being second-class citizens. I want to bring in the U.S. here, mostly because, you know, U.S. President Trump has declared that he will not allow Israel or permit Israel to annex the West Bank. But effectively, what's happening on the ground is annexation. And I believe that the U.S. has a major role in managing its relationship with Israel while also signaling constraints to Israel to prevent it from actually annexing the West Bank. So I think my fear right now is that Gaza is in dire straits, to say the least. There's so much going on over there, but our eyes are basically now on the West Bank, and we're, you know, a lot of observers are wondering what next.
Dalia Hatuka is a freelance journalist based in Amman, Jordan, and Ramallah in the West Bank. Thank you so much, Dalia.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Costa Rica is widely considered a wildlife preservation success story. Tourists go there by the millions to see wild sloths, toucans, monkeys, and sea turtles. There is a downside to this success, though. All those humans can harm the very animals the visitors come to see. In the story from our archives, Jamie Fullerton headed into the forest to tell us more.
They use the bathroom about every 5 to 7 days. They go down on the ground, they use their bums to do a little poop dance, and then they use the bathroom on the ground before they go back up another tree.
I'm on a guided tour in a wild animal sanctuary on Costa Rica's Caribbean coast. I'm learning a lot about sloths.
In the wild, where they have that kind of green color to them, that algae, that moss, that bacteria, and yes, parasites. Everyone thinks that sloths are super cute and cuddly. Sloths are dangerous and disgusting.
With its sloth-filled forests and turtle-friendly beaches, Costa Rica is known as a shining example of ecotourism done well. The small Central American country has strong wildlife protection laws and over the past 30 years managed the rare feat of reversing deforestation. But recently, there have been signs of new dangers for wildlife.
And last year, exactly 1,001 animals arrived here to the center. Those numbers are slowly increasing each year, especially due to deforestation and urbanization.
Many conservationists in Costa Rica believe that wild animals don't have enough protections from the effects of urban development and tourism. There are fears that deforestation is creeping back through illegal and legitimate development. New roads and plantations have isolated wildlife habitats, and more animals are being killed by cars and electricity wires.
There's one?
There's one, two fingers right there.
Two fingers sloth?
Yeah, you see in the pond?
I join a team from the Sloth Conservation Foundation, or SLOCO, near the small town of Puerto Viejo. On a patch of trees and grass between a beach and a hotel, we see two sloths high up in a tree.
He's there. He's sleeping now there. So there are two of them.
The SLOCO guys are putting up a green rope, about 100 feet long and 3 stories high, to connect treetops. Sloths have tendons in their hands and feet that lock into place so they can easily climb along ropes. The SLOCO charity has put up hundreds of ropes around here. These sloth bridges are designed to help wild animals travel around habitats degraded by development.
Sloths are a great species for understanding the implications of development because they can't run, they can't jump, they can't fly.
Rebecca Cliff is a British zoologist and the founder of SLOCO.
In order to move from tree to tree, sloths need the branches and the canopy to physically overlap.
Rampant logging took place in Costa Rica in the 1950s and 60s, and by 1987, only around one-fifth of the country's land had forest cover. Logging restrictions were brought in, alongside financial compensation for farmers protecting forests. By 2021, around 60% of land in Costa Rica was covered by forest. However, in the last few decades, road construction has geared up across the country, and the government has encouraged tourism infrastructure.
As soon as you get any kind of development, the first thing that happens is that we start cutting down trees, and the sloths can no longer move around. They're coming down to the ground, they're getting hit by cars, attacked by dogs, electrocuted when they climb on power lines. And it's happening in astonishing numbers, like really terrifying numbers.
Development among forests also causes species isolation. This is when wildlife species have their habitats limited because a road, farm, or structure creates barriers. In sloths, this causes problems such as lack of food and inbreeding. In Puerto Viejo, cars and ATVs chug along roads next to beach bars. The vehicles move under sloths perched in trees. Before coming here, in San Jose, I spoke with Alan Valverde, Dean of the University for International Cooperation's Faculty of Environment and Development.
At the beginning of the, for example, the creation of the Route 32, there was a scenario where you will find many animals dead. Big cats, raccoons, also anteaters, and many of those animals.
Valverde says that Route 32, a highway built in 1987, caused many animal deaths, and that species isolation wasn't properly considered in the road's planning. He says this is still a problem.
So what we are doing right now is to increase the size of the roads in order to have more lanes. This is one of the problems. But the other problem is that we don't create conditions to cross, like ecological bridges, to cross between one side to the other. So we are forgetting that.
The most stark example of the effects of species isolation here is the jaguar. This apex predator needs a huge amount of space to hunt, so forest fragmentation can be lethal for it. There are now believed to be only a few hundred jaguars in the wild in Costa Rica. A lack of jaguars can affect other species, such as peccaries, which are pig-like creatures the big cats eat.
The peccaries is an omnivorous animal. If I not regulate this population, they will eat all the roots of the plants, they will eat many of the small animals, and they will change all the ecological of the ecosystem.
Valverde says there should be robust conservation certification requirements for tourism companies. He wants private forest owners to be given more incentives by the government for wildlife protection, and for tourists to be better educated about minimizing their impact on habitats.
For me, Costa Rica is not a place for mass tourism. I understand that there's a huge tourist industry that depends on that, and I can change it. For me, the answer is to try to promote tourism that understand the fragility of the ecosystem, the nature of our country, in the condition of biodiversity.
Slow co-founder Rebecca Cliff says Costa Rica should force developers in towns like Puerto Viejo to have wildlife and environmental assessments. She also says authorities should focus on attracting fewer, higher-spending tourists.
It's been fantastic for the economy. So many people are coming to Costa Rica now to see sloths primarily. But with that, you get this massive development, right? So now it's gone the other way. It's gone too far.
With development not slowing, it seems like plenty more bridges need to be built to ensure that the country's reputation as a wildlife haven doesn't begin to fade. For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Puerto Viejo, Costa Rica.
In Iran this week, authorities sentenced in absentia the acclaimed film director Jafar Panahi to a year in prison. His crime? Creating propaganda against the government. He served prison time in Iran before. The 65-year-old is known for making edgy, politically charged thrillers. His latest movie has been winning top awards at international film festivals. It's called It Was Just an Accident, and my co-host Marco Werman spoke with Panahi about it recently. Marco, why is this film getting Panahi in trouble in Iran?
Well, Carolyn, for one thing, he filmed it secretly, illegally, inside Iran, even though there are wild scenes that definitely grabbed the attention of onlookers during the shoot, like a scene where police are taking bribes on an ATM, or this moment, in which a woman in a fluffy white wedding dress is pushing a broken-down van on a busy Tehran street. One of many moments of absurdity and humor.
Moments of humor, but this is not a light movie, right?
Yeah, I mean, when torture and forgiveness are the central themes, it's definitely not light. Call it complex, at the very least. It's Just an Accident is about a mechanic who has a chance encounter with a man whom he suspects is the same man who once tortured him in detention. The mechanic abducts him in a van, but then has doubts that he's kidnapped the right man. This sets up a chaotic ride through Tehran as he collects other people like the bride, who are also this man's victims.
And Marco, you spoke with Panahi when he came to our Boston studio last week through his interpreter, Shada Dayani. Let's hear your conversation.
Let's talk about what the film is about. It's a pretty remarkable story. What inspired the plot?
In prison, it's very common to share stories and memories with fellow prisoners, only as pastime. And those stories and exchanges will stay in one's mind and will come out somehow. And when I left prison, I felt responsible toward the fellow prisoners who were still inside. And this sense of responsibility and duty got heavier by the day until I decided to make a film about it. I asked myself where I could begin this film, and I realized that we all had a shared experience, and that was getting interrogated. While we were all blindfolded, we were sitting in front of a wall, and a man or an interrogator was walking behind us, asking questions, and we sometimes had to lift our blindfold and write down the answers. But then the auditory sense among all of us worked best and was strongest. And we all also wondered about our interrogators, what they looked like, who they were, and whether or not we were going to recognize them outside.
So let's talk about this one scene earlier on where two ex-prisoners are talking about this former torturer.
نه واسه همین اومدم سراغ شما
که چی؟
یعنی چی؟
گیرم که خودش باشه میخوای چی کار کنی؟
من خودم ردیفش میکنم شما نگران نباشید نمیخوام شما تو درد سر بیارید.
So these two former detainees are discussing what to do if this guy they've just kidnapped is actually their former interrogator and torturer. They get into this debate. What are they actually debating?
با اون میگه باید شناساییش بکنیم و اون میگه که من
In terms of what they say to each other, one of them, Vahid, wants to recognize the interrogator of them, wants to identify him, and Shiva says she cannot identify him because she was always blindfolded.
What's interesting is that not everyone in the group is in agreement about what to do with the man, even if they positively identify him as the torturer.
It is only natural for a person to first think about vengeance. But that's only the surface theme, and it's very simplistic. But the further we go, the more the humanistic conditions prevail. They start wondering, let's assume we kill him, what then? Are all of our problems going to fade? And this is exactly the point that the film wants to emphasize on. The themes of violence and forgiveness in this film are only on the facade, and they're only in order to move the plot forward. The bigger question is, how far is this cycle of violence going to continue?
Jafar Panahi, you spoke about the central question of the movie, the cycle of violence and how to end it. I mean, this question of the trauma of the person who's been tortured versus the trauma of the torture from perhaps another experience in life. It's a really interesting one. How do you think about that?
The characters keep repeating that this sound has been in their minds for several years. Of course, with all the sounds that they had in their minds all these years, they must have thought about the moment as such. What are they going to do if this moment comes? Perhaps the torturer, too, must have thought about what happens if he gets recognized one day. And they have both come to that point.
It's hard to imagine authorities don't know what you look like. What was the risk you took in filming in country?
مشکل این بود که وقتی ما اون سکانس
When we were shooting that ATM scene, after we finished, we left the team in that location, and a few of us got in the van to go to another scene. But then, after a few kilometers, they called us and asked us to come back. They told me that the set has been raided, and they're looking for me. They have surrounded the team. We had an opportunity to hide the equipment and the dailies, and we did. Then we returned, and they kept us on the street for about 4 or 5 hours. But of course, they couldn't get their hands on anything. And because they were under the impression that we had just started shooting, they let us go. The next morning, though, they asked some of the team members into questioning, and they told them that they can no longer continue working with this project. I also canceled the shooting for about a month. We had about 2 days of shooting left. So after a month, I went back with a smaller team, and we shot the only absolutely necessary shots in 1 day.
You have, as you said, been arrested and imprisoned for your work as a filmmaker, and your films are banned in Iran. At the same time, you're in some ways a country's cinematic record keeper. What is that like for you?
This is because I know no other work besides filmmaking. I only have one passport, and that is the Iranian passport.
So that's really interesting. How do you see the future of cinema in Iran?
Many of the short films that are being made now in Iran, or the feature films that are just getting started, are really amazing. They are way more audacious and way more motivated than we were. And this is what gives us hope for the future.
Iranian film director Jafar Panahi, he joined us in our studio in Boston, along with interpreter Shada Dayani. A big thanks to you both. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Iranian film director Jafar Panahi speaking through his interpreter with Marco Werman. This week, Panahi received 3 Gotham Awards for his film, It Was Just an Accident, while also being sentenced in absentia in Iran to a year in prison. Ambassadors know all about schmoozing. Going to dinners and cocktail parties is part of the job. But heavy metal concerts are not usually on the agenda, unless you are Freddie Lim, Taiwan's new top diplomat in Finland. That's Lim greeting concertgoers at the Formosa Finland Fest, a heavy metal show with 3 Taiwanese bands and 3 Finnish bands. Lim was on stage not just to represent Taiwan and its people, but to perform. The 2-term lawmaker is also the lead vocalist in a heavy metal band that's been around since 1995. Here's the Taiwanese broadcaster Formosa News reporting on the band's performance at the festival.
Lim is testing out a new approach to diplomacy through metal music, driving the crowd wild. Halfway through the concert, he even ripped off his top and showed his chiseled torso with a spectacular 8-pack. Photos of the concert have gone viral online in Taiwan and abroad.
In addition to apparently being in great shape, Lim is an unapologetic critic of the Chinese government, which plays into his goal with this new diplomatic post.
I try to let China and the world understand what the young people in Taiwan thinking. Maybe it will China off.
Lim is calling this the start of heavy metal diplomacy. People came out to Formosa Fest in droves, so evidently he can read a room. The This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. There is a military base in Kenya that the British Army uses for training. The terrain, climate, and open spaces in Kenya allow for large-scale exercises the UK cannot do at home. This arrangement has been going on for decades. But there have also been complaints from local communities about the behavior of soldiers in the British Army Training Unit Kenya, known as Batuk. Now, Kenyan lawmakers have finished a 2-year investigation finding a pattern of misconduct. The allegations link UK soldiers to unsolved killings and sexual abuse. For more, we reached out to investigative journalist John Allen Namu. He is the co-founder of the media outlet Africa Uncensored.
The base itself is right next to the town of Nanyuki, but where they conduct their trainings, those are in far more rural areas, but the communities that live there are nomadic. A lot of them are nomadic. And so you will find certain encampments from time to time that the British soldiers would come into contact with. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a presence and has been for a number of decades.
Right. And a pattern of misconduct is what the Kenyan lawmakers have found after a 2-year inquiry. Some of this misconduct is quite disturbing. Can you run through a bit of what they uncovered?
Numerous incidents of sexual misconduct, sexual abuse, rape, a number of cases of abandonment. So soldiers fathering children with women and then not taking parental responsibility.
Mm. So abandoning those kids.
Yes. But I think one of the more pernicious or long-running cases and patterns of misconduct has to do with that kind of sexual misconduct, which I personally investigated the murder of Agnes Wanjiru, a young girl who was murdered and her body dumped in a septic tank by soldiers from the Lancaster's regiment who were just about to ship out to Afghanistan in 2012. That murder was revealed to the higher-ups in the British Army the night that it took place.
Back in 2012,
but was hidden and was covered up for almost a decade before formal investigations were conducted.
And a British soldier was just arrested for that alleged murder just last month. Yes. After years of campaigning by the victim's family. Why has it taken so long?
There's a culture of covering up the sins of soldiers from the British Army.
Who is doing the covering up?
The British Army mostly is the one that does the covering up of the same. They do that with the allegiance of low-level law enforcement officers. There also are incidents of unexploded ordnances being left and children and individuals who are roaming the savannas, they're being injured or killed by some of these unexploded ordnances. There are a number of things that are layered upon the relationship between Britain and Kenya.
Why is this just triggering a parliamentary investigation now? It sounds like a lot of these issues have been known about for a very long time.
Well, because the arrangement is very beneficial to Kenya. Kenya and Britain have a very strong military partnership coming out of the colonial relationship that Britain and Kenya have had. Kenya's security units have been beneficiaries of training. It's also quite lucrative. The British Army pays for its being able to set up a base there. And I think examining this relationship came after a very slow build of complaints that came from the bottom up, essentially from citizens. And many times it's very difficult for those kinds of complaints to penetrate right up to the rungs of society that could actually do things in terms of policy. But it does speak to a very cozy relationship between the political elite in Kenya and the political elite in Britain that have covered this up for a number of years.
A spokesperson for Britain's defense ministry told Reuters that the ministry deeply regrets the challenges that have arisen in relation to our defense presence in Kenya. How is the UK saying it plans to address this?
Well, we're not sure yet. I'm sure that there will be some sort of compensation that will go to the families that have been affected, perhaps starting with Agnes Wanjiru's family. But it's important to listen to the language that these kinds of regrets are couched in. It's regret. It's not an express apology. And an express apology would imply that there are certain kinds of responsibilities that Britain does have to Kenya. An express apology would also implicate specific soldiers, specific acts. So to express that, yes, that there are things that happened that shouldn't have happened, but we're not claiming responsibility mm-hmm. in totality for it, which is what the people in Laikipia want, like a clear, contrite expression of apology for many of the sins that have taken place on Kenyan soil.
How do Kenyans currently view this training facility? I mean, several battalions a year are still rotating through it, right?
It's mixed. We can't ignore the fact that there has been some benefit to the local communities there. There have been, you know, cash injections that come with having a military base that's run by a foreign country on your soil. A number of businesses have benefited from it. A number of businesses have sprung up from it. The local community does benefit. But when you look at it in totality, those benefits pale in comparison to the cost that Kenya has had to bear in terms of giving up its land. Many of the migratory routes of the nomadic communities that are there have been interrupted for decades. The military presence of the British there is a throwback to colonial days. The base itself is quite close to where the heart of the battle against colonialists took place, you know, over 65 years ago. So it's not a pleasant memory for very many Kenyans.
Mm. Is there any talk of stopping this program, not allowing British soldiers to be trained at these bases anymore?
So I've spoken to some of the members of parliament who are involved in this investigation, and there seems to be that kind of, conversation taking place at that level. There certainly more openly have been these kinds of conversations online as well as on the ground. I'm not sure that this is going to stop anytime soon, because that partnership is very central to Britain's ability to be able to train its troops. It's also quite lucrative for Kenya. And rolling back these kinds of agreements would be not devastating, but it would really change the posturing of Kenya and Britain as development partners, their diplomatic relationship. I'm not hopeful that it's going to take place anytime soon, despite the parliamentary investigation, in as much as a lot of Kenyans, myself included, would not want the presence of a foreign military power on our soil.
John Allen Namu is an investigative journalist with Africa Uncensored. He joined the show today from California. The World is produced from GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.